I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The oil boom from hydraulic fracturing in the U.S. and Canada has had a dramatic impact on this country's railroad system. According to the Associated Press, almost 500,000 tank cars filled with crude oil were transported by railroads in 2014, compared to just 9,500 in 2008. More trains have meant more accidents, including several fiery derailments. There are safety concerns in the densely populated Philadelphia region because of the increased number of trains carrying crude oil to local refineries. This morning on Radio Times, we want to talk about the risks and regulation of oil tanker train traffic and explore the overall safety of our nation's rail systems. And we have two guests who have joined us. Alan Zaremski is a research professor, also director of the Railroad Engineering and Safety Program in the Department of Civil Engineering at the University of Delaware. He was a consultant specializing in railroad track engineering and safety. Alan Zaremski, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be here.
Also with us is Curtis Tate, and he covers transportation and infrastructure for McClatchy. He has written extensively on railroad safety. Curtis Tate, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. And Curtis, let me begin with you. If we're talking about this increased train traffic, is this driven largely by the Bakken oil coming out of North Dakota?
It is largely driven by the Bakken shale region of North Dakota, which is producing now about a million actually more than a million barrels a day. And about 60 to 70% of this production moves by rail, and it goes largely to refineries on the east and west coast, of course, the Philadelphia, Delaware, New Jersey area, and also Northwest Washington State. That's really about the only way it can get there.
To you, Alan, and this is broadly speaking, and then we'll take it apart during this hour, as you look at our railroad system, is it capable of carrying this much crude oil around the country?
The capacity exists to carry this crude oil. The issue is going to be to maintaining the level of safety that the public has become used to from the railroads.
Well, and safety having to do with several fiery derailments in the last couple of weeks, frankly. What's the explanation?
Well, the explanation is that we're suddenly carrying a commodity that we've just seen very recently, as you've just heard, increase dramatically. And this particular commodity, crude by rail, seems to be more at risk to a fiery incident in the event of a derailment. The safety of the railways from the point of view of actual number of derailments occurring it continues to go down. In fact, if you look at the statistics over the last 10 years, there's a steady downward trend in derailments and train accidents of that sort. But as the percentage of crude by rail trains increase, the occasional derailment that happens, now there's a risk of a rupture of a tank car. And it appears to be that the Bakken crude seems to have a fairly high level of volatility that in the event of a rupture can result in a more dramatic type of incident and certainly a more dangerous type of incident.
Curtis, I'm sorry. No, finish your thought. I'm sorry. Go ahead there, Alan.
Okay. So there are really three ingredients necessary for the kind of dramatic derailments incidences that we've seen. Number one, you need to have the actual derailment. And most derailment causes, and we can talk about this a little bit, but most derailment causes have nothing to do with the tank car trains themselves. So there's a derailment. Then when there's a derailment, you still then have to have the rupture of the tank car. And in many, many instances, the tank cars do not rail. And again, we'll talk about this.
Sure.
Because this is where a lot of the legislative efforts are aimed at. The improvements in tank cars are actually aimed at improving the rupture. Preventing the rupture of a tank car in the event of a derailment. And then the third issue is, of course, the presence of this high volatile commodity that's being carried.
And I want to pick up on all of that. And I do want to go back to you, Curtis, and go back to the article that you wrote most recently. In fact, you begin your article describing a bridge in Alabama. A bridge that's about 116 years old, being used quite extensively. Describe that bridge for our listeners.
Well, this bridge is roughly a mile long. As you said, it's more than 100 years old. The main steel span over the river is it's a steel span, but the rest of it is a timber structure. And what we noticed about it last year is that many of the supporting members of this bridge were very badly deteriorated. Some rotted, some missing, and others patched up in a somewhat haphazard manner. And after calling, various entities about it, state, local, federal, it became pretty clear that nobody had really, there was really no oversight of this bridge. Basically, the railroad was responsible for inspecting and maintaining it. And after those calls got made and before the story went out, they actually did start repairing the bridge. They invested about $2.5 million into it.
But
one thing though to point out about the oil, the particular type of crude oil that crosses that bridge almost on a daily basis, is it's not the Bakken crude that we've been talking about that comes from North Dakota. It's not the fracked oil. It's actually a diluted version of heavy crude from Canada, tar sands or oil sands, depending on who you ask. And as we've seen actually in two recent derailments in Northern Ontario, the diluted version of that heavy crude also poses an explosion and fire risk in derailments. It turns out it's not just the Bakken.
Picking up on this bridge that you described, Curtis, do you think that's an outlier when we talk about railroad infrastructure? Or do you think this is an example of a system in need of upgrade and repair?
Well, it's not an isolated case, I don't think. The second thing is, railroads do actually have a fairly powerful economic incentive to not derail trains and to not have bridge failures. So they do put a certain amount of investment into their infrastructure. I think the professor could probably address that a little bit better than I could. But clearly there are deficiencies in certain places and concerns about it. There are certainly a large number of older structures around Philadelphia, for example, that people have been concerned about.
Alan Zaremski, let me go back to you then. Who is responsible then for, let's say, inspecting the infrastructure of railroads, whether it's the tracks or whether it's bridges? Is it the railroad companies themselves? Is it the U.S. Department of Transportation? Who is ultimately responsible?
The railroads have primary responsibility for the inspection and maintenance of their own infrastructure, or their own right-of-way. They pay for the maintenance of the infrastructure out of their own pocket, out of their own income. And as Curtis pointed out, they have some very strong economic incentives to do a good job. Now, above the railroad's primary responsibility for inspection, the Federal Railway Administration has safety oversight for the United States. And what that means is they have a cadre of professional inspectors, plus they have a sophisticated inspection equipment like track geometry cars of their own to check on the railroads. But you can think of it almost as a spot check of the railroads. Or if there's concern about safety, and this has happened in the past, mm-hmm. if there's been concern about safety in a given location, then there's an increased degree of emphasis put on by the FRA to increase inspection. But the primary inspection responsibility is the railroads themselves.
Let me go back to something that Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf did recently. He wrote to President Obama. He said Pennsylvania is seeing some of the largest volume of Bakken crude oil transport by rail in the United States, something like 60 to 70 oil trains a week that go across the state. His concern is that that Pennsylvania only has something like 6 inspectors to monitor the rails. Is there a need, Alan Zaremski, for more inspectors?
I'm going to hedge that answer by saying I would probably have to do a safety analysis to do that. That's one of the things I do is do things like safety risk analyses. But remember, you still have the primary railroad inspectors. You still have the FRA. The state inspectors are not in lieu of the FRA. They're in addition to or supplemental to the federal inspectors. So whether the six are sufficient or not, I can't answer that for you right now because I haven't analyzed it. But I will say that the primary railroad inspection criteria, and by the way, the things like frequency of inspection, mm-hmm. minimum frequency of inspection, are mandated by the Federal Railway Administration as well. So the number of inspections that must be made as an absolute minimum are dictated by federal law. Most railroads, particularly on high-density lines or high-risk lines, will actually inspect more aggressively. For example, and I'll give you an example, broken rails are a serious category of derailments or accidents. And they tend to happen at speed, so there tends to be a lot of energy. And a number of the CBR, the crude by rail accidents that have occurred over the last year and a half have been associated with broken rails. FRA mandates approximately one inspection a year. It can be a little bit more under certain circumstances. But railroads can inspect as often as 3, 4, 5 times a year if they feel that the risks associated with the number of defects or the age of the rail warrant it. So there are many instances where the railroads will inspect far in excess of these minimum standards.
Curtis, about a minute before our first break here, looking at the numbers and kinds of inspections, does it seem like it's up to snuff and up to the increased use of rails to carry this crude oil?
Well, Marty, I wanted to add that that most of the states that I've talked to, they have basically four kinds of rail inspectors. They have track inspectors, they have signal inspectors, hazardous materials inspectors, and employee safety inspectors. But at this point, no state has a bridge inspection, a railroad bridge inspection program. And in fact, only California is really actually developing one.
Do you see bridges as a kind of a vulnerability within the system, Curtis?
That seems to be an area of concern to a lot of governors and state legislatures and state departments of transportation and you know, public service commissions, the state agencies that tend to have a role in regulating rail safety.
And that's Curtis Tate. He covers transportation and infrastructure for McClatchy. Excuse me. He's written extensively on railroad safety. Also with us is Alan Zaremski, excuse me, research professor, director of the Railroad Engineering and Safety Program at the University of Delaware. We are talking about the regulation and the risks and the safety related to our railway system. We'll take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Curtis Tate and Alan Zaremski. We are talking about the safety of our nation's railway system, the condition of tracks, causes of accidents, responsibilities for oversight. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times if you have any questions or comments for our guests. Curtis, going back to you and even going back to this pretty extensive article that you had recently in McClatchy, is there enough transparency, enough data sharing when it comes to the Railway Administration and ensuring that local officials know what's happening in their state?
Well, what the Department of Transportation did after the derailment in Lynchburg, Virginia last April was it began requiring rail companies transporting large volumes of Bakken crude specifically to notify state emergency officials of the approximate weekly volume of those shipments and the routes they take and the counties through which they pass. And they started doing this about the middle of last year in June. And Some states were willing to make those records available through the open records process, and others were a bit more reluctant to do so because the railroads had asked them to keep the documents confidential. Pennsylvania was one of those states that initially resisted, but we and two Pittsburgh newspapers appealed PEMA's decision, Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency's decision to not share the documents, and ultimately we did get a reversal, and the documents were posted in full. But I might add that that Delaware is still one of those states that resists making those documents available. So does West Virginia, the site of a very recent Bakken oil train incident. We were able to get the information about the Bakken shipments from roughly 25 states, but a few others have resisted making those available.
Alan, should there be transparency? Should there be data sharing?
Well, there is a fair bit of transparency between the railroads and the federal government. And then the data sharing between the federal government and the states, I think, is really an issue between government agencies. Since the railroads are governed under the Interstate Commerce legislative acts over the last centuries, their primary responsibility in terms of reporting and safety oversight and operations is through the federal government. There are increasing levels of cooperation at the state and local level. There's increasing emphasis by railroads to train first responders and provide them with skills and capability and information. But ultimately, I think the information that Curtis is referring to, you're dealing in a sense almost with sort of a federal state type of interaction.
I mean, sounds like some bureaucracy needs to have a little fire lit under its butt, Alan's. Yes?
Yes.
to ensure that kind of transparency and information sharing. I want to ask about a car that I was reading about. This is one of these tank cars. It's called a DOT-111. Can you describe that for us, Alan?
Okay. Let's sort of talk about two generations of tank cars. Rather, you know, the tank car you're referring to really refers to what we call the older generation tank cars, which has not the same level of puncture resistance and protection against loss of integrity that the new legislative classes of tank cars have. But tank cars have over the last, as far as I know, 40 years. I've been in the industry 40 years, and I've seen continuous improvement in tank cars, you know, over its entire 40-year period. So what you see happening now is you see emphasis on three major areas where you're trying to improve the resistance of a tank car to puncture or spill in the event of a derailment. Remember, this goes back to what I said before, that first you need the derailment. And
right.
Most of the time, the derailment event is really not a function of the tank car. The tank cars are not derailment prone in the sense that you're going to get more derailments from a tank car. That's not happening.
It's about the tracks, right? It's about the condition
well,
of the track.
We're digressing, but I think it's an important digression. If you look at the derailment statistics, approximately 35%, roughly between 33 and 37% of the derailments are actually operations and human factors, switching, yard movements, things of those sorts. A second category, roughly in the 30 to 32% range, are track. So those are the big two. Almost 70% of all derailments are associated with either operations and human factors or track. A distant third is equipment causes. And by the way, most equipment causes are wheels, axles, and bearings. And that represents maybe around 15%. And then the last 15% is sort of in the signals are in there in about 3 or 4%. Signals are a very small percentage of derailments. They're about 3 or 4%. And then the rest is a catch-all miscellaneous class. Okay, so having said that, what we have is when we have a derailment, And we do have derailments. We have about last year we had approximately 1,800 derailments in the United States. If there's sufficient energy in the derailment, and we can talk about these as to what is required in a bit, but as if there's sufficient energy in the derailment, you can have damage, you can have rupture of the tank car. So this is where the design of the tank car that you're referring to comes in and becomes very important. So what you have is you have the shell of the tank car. You have what's called a head shield, which is, think of it as a shield to prevent a coupler. In the event of a train separating or a car separating, you have the couplers that connect the cars. They stick out a little bit like a spear. And so there's a potential for that coupler to penetrate the end of the shell. So we literally put a head shield to deflect that coupler so we don't get penetration. So that's a second area. And then the third area is that there are two sets of valves in most tank cars. There are top valves and there are bottom valves, loading valves, unloading valves, safety release valves. And then there's an increasing effort to protect those valves so in the event of the derailment, they don't become damaged and be a cause of release of the crude in the car. So the older cars, which is the ones you were referring to, they have a reasonable amount of thickness in the wall, and they have partial head shields, and they have some limited protection of the valves, but the new with the risks that we're seeing with CBR, the FRA and the industry. By the way, there's a lot of joint cooperation between the Association of American Railways and the tank car manufacturers through the Railway Progress Institute and of course the Federal Railway Administration. They're issuing new regulations upgrading the strength or the puncture resistance of the tank cars in the event of a derailment. So they'll either increase the thickness of the shell, or they'll put an external jacket on the shell. They'll increase the size and thickness of the head shield, and they'll increase the level of protection around the valves.
And let me just jump in here. Yeah, let me just jump in here and give you, Curtis, a chance to weigh in on this. You wrote a bit about you described the kind of workhorse .111 tank car. The NTSB has been warned about it for decades. Can you weigh in on this car?
Sure. There are tens of thousands of these tank cars in service, and they've largely moved this surge in energy production that we've seen over the past several years, not just crude oil, but also ethanol. The industry did voluntarily adopt a more rigorous construction standard for the DOT 111s beginning in October 2011. They do generally, as the professor said, have shields on the ends of the cars. They have better protections for the valves. But one thing that left optional, or a couple of things that left optional, was thermal insulation around the shell of the car to protect against fire exposure, and then also an outer steel jacket around the car to provide additional puncture resistance. And one thing that unites the four recent derailments that we saw in Ontario, West Virginia, and Illinois is all of these trains consisted of the newer CPC 1232 car, they call it, but they all lacked jackets and thermal insulation. And what happens then is the train derails, a car or a couple of cars puncture, it releases the contents ignite, and then the surrounding cars that didn't get puncture are exposed to that fire. And then after a certain period of time that they're exposed to that fire, they rupture, and that's where you see those enormous fireballs that shoot hundreds of feet into the air. We talked to some witnesses in West Virginia about that. It was just it was an incredible scene for them.
Imagine.
So that's something that the new pending regulations from USDOT are supposed to address, the puncture resistance of the tank cars, and also their ability to survive prolonged fire exposure.
Ellen, we live in a densely populated area. You're down there in Delaware. We're here in Philadelphia. Do you have concerns about the numbers of trains? And my understanding, it's something like 45 to maybe as much as 80 oil trains that come through Philadelphia just about every week. Are you concerned about safety issues?
Well, as a railroad professional, I'm always concerned about safety issues. Safety, I will tell you, I've been in this industry for 40 years, and safety has been an issue and has been ingrained in me from day one. So, yes, and professionally, I deal in an area of risk management where we're continuously trying to reduce the risk. So, absolutely, I'm concerned with safety. And when you're dealing with a commodity such as CBR, crude by rail, where a derailment has the potential of resulting in a very catastrophic incident, then safety takes on increased emphasis. So the question becomes, how do you address the safety concerns? Some of the FRA and the AAR jointly and separately are taking multiple actions. In addition to the upgrades of the tank car that both Curtis and I spoke about, you're talking about issues associated with reducing speed potentially in high-risk areas, which, again, if you remember, we go back to this issue that if you have a derailment and you don't have the first rupture, then you're probably not going to have an incident.
Right.
So one of the things that happens is if you reduce speed, you can reduce the energy available for the derailment, and that has the potential of reducing the probability of rupture. And there have been studies on this, and there's ongoing research as we speak. Now, there's a downside, of course, which is when you decrease speed, you slow down the railroad and you reduce capacity. You can't run as many trains. And so that has some serious impacts. So that's an area that you have to trade off speed versus capacity. It's a serious issue. It's not a, you know, it's a non-trivial issue, but certainly the denser the population, the more potential you have for reducing speed. Then you have issues like, can I upgrade my efforts to even prevent a derailment in the first place? And the answer is yes, there are things you can do for certain classes of derailments. You know, I alluded to a broken rail derailment a few moments ago. You can increase the frequency of ultrasonic inspection for internal defects. You can lower the allowable level of risk that you're willing to live with, which is the case with you dealing with a high incident commodity such as crude by rail. And then that can trigger a more severe inspection regime that would hopefully reduce the number of derailments. And we have many years with the statistical data that correlates the certain classes of inspection criteria with certain, you know, with the risk of derailment. So there are things we can do to respond to it. But yes, of course, we're concerned.
Curtis, going back to you and even raising the issue about emergency preparedness, are responders being trained, local responders, thinking that because of all this increased rail traffic, people have to know and be trained how to deal in case there is an accident?
Let me talk about that in a second, but I did want to make a quick point about speed.
Sure.
Which is that the Department of Transportation and the railroads agreed that in certain high density urban centers, including Philadelphia, the train speeds for oil trains would be no more than 40 miles an hour. Well, if you look at the speeds at which recent derailments occurred, the West Virginia derailment, that was 33 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. The Illinois derailment was 23 miles an hour. The Lynchburg, Virginia derailment last year was 24 miles an hour. It's actually thought that the speeds aren't the speed reductions aren't necessarily completely effective at averting these derailments. They may help lessen the impact somewhat. With respect to emergency response, the industry did last year send about 1,500 first responders from around the country to its new firefighting academy in Pueblo, Colorado, where they actually do simulate an oil train derailment response. You know, there's an actual fire, and they use special equipment to extinguish it. And the railroads themselves have also been bringing training to communities across their networks. CSX, for example, has a safety train, and they went to 19 cities last year. So there are efforts to do this, and FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is going to contribute some funding toward training additional personnel out in Pueblo. But you know, the fact is there are tens of thousands of fire departments across the country, and most of them, especially in rural areas, are volunteer. They may not necessarily have the time or the personnel to go to Pueblo, even if somebody else pays for it. The rail industry usually pays for it, but it's an enormous challenge, and it's something that's of a major concern to a lot of folks. And I think just this week, Senator Casey advocated additional funding to train first responders to deal with these kinds of events.
And Alan, we're almost up on a break here. Does that seem like a wise investment?
Yes, and the railway industry, as Curtis pointed out, is investing heavily. Over the years, they've significantly upgraded the hazardous material and emergency responder training at the Transportation Test Center in Pueblo, Colorado, and they are investing resources into the first responder training, and it's a very important area.
And that's Alan Zaremski. He's a research professor, also director of the Railroad Engineering and Safety Program in the Department of Civil Engineering at the University of Delaware. Also with us is Curtis Tate. He covers transportation and infrastructure for McClatchy. He has written extensively on railroad safety, and that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mazza-Cohen. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf and Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey and Philadelphia City Council all raised concerns recently about the increased number of trains carrying crude oil through the state, especially in densely populated areas like here in the Delaware Valley. Again, talking with Curtis Tate and Alan Zaremski about assessing the safety of the nation's rail system, including the condition of the tracks, the causes of accidents, responsibilities for oversight. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Alan, we have a tweet from Rebecca who says the Federal Railroad Administration suggests that oil refiners should take more responsibility for train safety. Philadelphia Energy Solutions is the big consumer of Bakken crude that would be here in the Delaware Valley. Should they fund safety measures, not Pennsylvania taxpayers? Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, in a sense, that goes back to my very first statement that says there are three ingredients for a crude incident. Number one is the derailment. Number two is the puncture. And number two is the volatility. And this, I think she's addressing the third one.
Yep.
Because there's some discussions and there's some suggestion among the authorities in that field. And I will say that volatility of petroleum is not one of my areas of expertise, but from what I understand, there are measures that can be taken to reduce the volatility prior to shipment. And if that's the case, the issue is who pays for it, exactly as Rebecca indicated. And, certainly having a sharing of the costs among several of the major parties, makes sense. And, putting some of that burden, not necessarily always on the taxpayer, and also on other entities, has some potential, provided it's done in an equitable and fair fashion.
Let me see what Rodney from Phoenixville has to say. Rodney, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Marty, for allowing me to comment.
Sure.
I am suspecting that the crude coming from the Bakken and the oil sand, tar sands, is heavier than the oil that has typically been, or the loads for those type of cars that have been shipped on Conrail. And I'm wondering if that combined with the extra long trains is stressing the tracks more than most loads.
Well, Rodney, actually, let me toss that first to you, Curtis Tate, and then to you, Alan Zarimsky. Curtis, do you want to weigh in on that at all?
Well, there is some thought that that because you have basically 100 or more cars, tank cars full of crude oil, coupled together and you know, moving over hills and around curves, that it does change the way that that these trains are handled. And one of the things that the Federal Railroad Administration proposed as a safety upgrade is electronically controlled braking, because the current braking system for trains involves compressed air, and rather than braking the car simultaneously, it goes basically one at a time down the line. So it's not something that that you hear discussed about a lot, but it could be that these trains do have different physics and different levels of kinetic energy, and perhaps the professor could address that a little bit.
Sure. And Alan, let me just add to that my understanding that a number of these trains are maybe 50 to as many as 100 cars long. Is that unusual?
No, it's not. Let me. There were two parts to the gentleman's questions. Let me answer the first part first, which is the weight of the cars themselves. The weight of the cars is absolutely restricted to a maximum of 286,000 pounds weight, gross weight. That's fully loaded weight of the car. That's the car plus whatever commodity goes into the car, be it feathers, lead, crude oil, or coal, or anything else. So there is no concern from the sense of the cars being heavier than what's allowed in open and free interchange movement. And there are numerous way stations and wheel measurement installations along the route to check to make sure that's the case. Now, the second issue is the long, heavier trains.
Right.
The North American railway industry routinely operates 110, 120 car trains weighing 14,000 tons in total train weight. That's not an unusual. We run them through the Rocky Mountains. We run them through the Canadian Rockies. We run them all over. So as Curtis indicated, there are train handling issues, and most crews who operate those routes are familiar with and undergo fairly extensive training in terms of train handling. But because the braking system is a pneumatic braking system, it's an air system, for the air signal to get from the front of the train to the rear of the train takes a few seconds, takes a little bit amount of time. So one of the innovations that has been developed over the years and has been tested over the last number of years is what we call electro-pneumatic braking, where we use an electrical signal to trigger the air brakes. We still have the air brakes. We're not replacing the air brakes. But instead of relying on the speed of sound, basically the airline to send the signal to the back of the train, we have a separate electrical signal that can go to the back of the train that can trigger the train's braking throughout the train instantaneously. That does help train handling. That is part of the FRA requirement. Most of the recent CBR derailments that we've seen are really not affected by that, but there's a sufficient class of train handling related derailments that, from a safety oversight point of view, that's certainly a measure that can be taken that will improve the overall safety of the operation.
Curtis, I have an email for you. This is from Michael. He says, as a fire officer, what I really need to know is what material and how much of it is moving through my territory so I can properly plan for it. And I wonder, from your reporting, does that seem like a common concern or comment that you have found talking with people about this issue?
It is a very common concern, and there are a couple of ways that you can go about finding out. One is through the state, whatever state emergency management agency there is. They should have a at least some limited information from the railroads themselves. And actually, you can also go to the railroad. In some cases, there are apps where you can actually find out about not just crude oil shipments, but other kinds of hazmat that's moving through the community. So the lines of communication between railroads and emergency responders have improved over the past, say, year and a half or so. But I think the wide consensus is that there's still a lot of progress to be made there.
Alan, we could do a whole hour on people and cars crossing railroad tracks. And I just want to raise one or two issues. I see some callers do as well. And there have been a number of, you know, really scary, fatal accidents of trains and cars and trucks colliding on these railroad tracks. Is that largely the fault of people trying to run the trains before they get to the tracks?
Unfortunately, yes. It's either running the trains, stopping on the tracks, or in some cases, like one of the recent accidents, being stuck in a traffic jam and putting on your normal traffic jam mentality, of which is just creep behind the car behind you, you know, continuously, instead of, wait a minute, I'm coming to a grade crossing. Let me stop on the safe side of the grade crossing until there's enough room on the other side for me to get clear. And for whatever reason, I do not want to be caught in a traffic jam in the grade crossing. That was one of the recent derailments and one of the recent accidents, unfortunately, that received a lot of press.
Let me get to Lynn from, looks like, Fleetwood, Pennsylvania, to join us. Hi, Lynn. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is, who do you contact if you see a truck stuck on the tracks? There's no imminent train, but you need to tell the engineer. Who contacts the engineer? Who knows where that train is?
Sure. Lynn, let me give Alan a chance to weigh in on that.
That's an excellent question, and it actually came up in the recent truck derailment. Every grade crossing in the United States has one or more signs prominently posted that says, in an emergency, call this number, and they have a number. And that number connects you to the railroad. And if you call up that number and you say there's a train or truck stuck on the tracks, that information goes to the train dispatcher, who contacts the train engineer and says, slow down to the point where you can stop on sight distance, so that all of a sudden, if there's a potential, because normally a train is going too fast to be able to stop once they see something. But if you're warned that there may be something obstructing the grade crossing, obstructing the track, you can slow the train down to the point where he can stop. And that's why it is so critical to make use of this phone number that's prominently shown on every grade crossing in the United States. That's actually by law has to be in every grade crossing.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Let me see what John from Louisville, Kentucky has to say. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, and as in the news, as you see in Louisville, Kentucky, we just had one of those same grade accidents.
Yep.
And the one thing that I called the reporter at the Courier-Journal and talked with her yesterday about, that the article didn't include what happened to the crew that was on that train. I'm a locomotive engineer, and I have a first seat. I have a first row seat to these accidents, and the amount of grief that I go through. And I've had these same accidents that we're speaking about, where I've run over a drunk person, unfortunately. But the thing for reporters to know is that there's two workers on that train that can get out and take care of, you know, we're kind of like the pre-responders, especially in derailments, we're the pre-responders. And the other thing I wanted to say is that we're talking about some very important issues, for sure, but we're not talking about worker retaliation for inspection of cars, which is terrible in the industry. We're not talking about Six Sigma or behavioral-based safety. And I might suggest that you look at Pound Rail Con 15, which is the conference in Richmond, California, that I just came from. So, and speaking of the...
Well, you know what, John? Let me just jump in here, only because I do want to give Curtis Tate a chance to respond. He's a reporter. He's been covering transportation infrastructure, writing extensively on railroad safety. So I want to give him a chance to weigh in on your comments. And I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We haven't really, Curtis, talked about the human beings who are driving these trains and are responsible for these trains in many ways.
Well, that's exactly right, and I'm a native Kentuckian, by the way. So hi to the folks back at home. That's one thing that doesn't get talked about in a lot of these incidents. The men and women who operate the trains, for the most part, are responsible for the generally good safety record of railroads, but when you're coming on a car stuck at a railroad crossing at 50 miles an hour, there's just not a whole lot you can do. You can sound the horn and hope that helps, but once the impact has happened, I mean there's really nothing you can do, and that's a very traumatic experience for anybody who's been through it. And also, in some cases, they sacrifice their lives. The engineer in the Metrolink accident in Southern California a few weeks ago actually later died of his injuries and was the only fatality related to that incident.
One of the things, Alan, that our caller John said was about worker retaliation, that I guess workers who are concerned about some of these safety issues from his perspective have been retaliated against. Can you speak to that?
I guess it's a little bit different than most of the information I get. And he's on the inside of the worker, the train operation. Most of the time, what I see is a fairly strong safety culture trying to be built up within the railway industry because safety is good business. On top of everything else, safety is good business. Whenever there's a derailment, whenever there's an accident, it's very expensive for the railroads. They would just as soon not have them as well. I guess I have not seen the worker retaliation portion of that, and maybe that's only because I've never been on that side of the of the activity.
Have you heard about that, Curtis?
Yes, there are a couple of examples that I'm aware of where workers were disciplined for basically reporting injuries that they sustained. Whether there's a systemic effort to discourage workers from reporting injuries throughout the industry, I don't know. There may be some isolated cases of it, but there are some examples where that's happened, and the workers have sued and have actually won significant judgments in court.
Alan, we're almost out of time here, but would you say there is room for improvement? Obviously, no system is going to be perfect, but we can have a safer railway system?
There's always room for improvement, and that's the goal of the industry. That's the goal of the Federal Railway Administration. Again, if you look at the trends have been downward pretty consistently. And the goal of a lot of the research, for example, that's funded by the industry and the government and done by people like myself and others, is to look at ways of improving safety incrementally. And the reason we have to do it incrementally is there's not a whole lot of low-hanging fruit. There's no sort of, if we did this, then automatically we'd eliminate all derailments. Even things as expensive as positive train control will only address a small number of derailments. So we will continue to work in that area because it's in the interest of the public, it's in the interest of the government, it's in the interest of the citizens, and it's in the interest of the railroads themselves.
Well, we have to end on that note. Alan Zarimsky, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you. Director of the Railroad Engineering and Safety Program at the University of Delaware, Curtis Tate, thank you for joining us as well.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. He covers transportation and infrastructure for McClatchy. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. And do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.